to advertise, email podcast@thisismatchy.com.
Release yourself from order and logic and enter a new place. It's not work. It's not home. Here, no maps have been drawn. No books have been written. Nothing is certain. Everything is possible. Welcome to podcast and chill with Matt G.
I'm assuming this doesn't end well.
Henda, you're now entering a space for Black history. Welcome to Black excellence. Do not fear, for if you do, just sip on some grandeur.
We got 107 views!
Okay, welcome to episode of this podcast and chill.
We are back.
Is it like a standard for you to greet it?
We got a special announcement to make today, 7th of November, 2020. Give it up for the one and only Saul Penduka. So the next milestone, Saul, are you ready for this? We're trying to fill up Sunbet Arena in Pretoria for our 1 million subscribers event.
1 million?
1 million.
Hey, but I'm scared about this one, Saul.
Hinda Barmeni, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special edition of Podcast and Chill. A few weeks ago, we wanted to have a discussion around load shedding, the energy crisis. So we're like, you know what, it'd be a dope idea to have a round table with some experts, guys who really know about this stuff because we don't know much about it. And it's finally happening today. So let me introduce you to our special guests. I'm going to start off with Mthunzi Luthuli. Afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm okay. Yeah, how are you?
So you're an engineer by profession, eh?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Where have you worked?
I've worked, I started off working in the manufacturing sector.
Yeah.
I worked for Unilever in Durban in their soap factory.
Yeah.
Making soap.
Yeah.
The Lux that you used this morning, we used to manufacture
that. Yeah, yeah. I'm a Sunlight boy, but yeah.
Carry okay. We used to make Sunlight as well. And then after that, I worked for BKS Incorporated. BKS stood for Brunet, Kruger and Stoffberg.
Yeah.
It was one of the biggest engineering consulting companies in South Africa at the time.
Nice.
And then I worked for Hatch. Again, Hatch is an engineering company, but they are Canadian. Yeah. Doing all sorts of things for Eskom and mining companies and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I run my own business.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I've also worked at Transnet and in the oil sector. I worked for Total.
Yeah.
South Africa. Yeah.
Fantastic. And then also joined by Benny Mulala.
Is that
the way you pronounce it?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're also an engineer, eh?
That's correct. Yeah.
And your background?
My background is in metallurgy, so I'm an engineering metallurgist, and I'm also a chemical engineer and a researcher, and I'm also in academia, lecturing at the University of Johannesburg. So I've worked in mining companies, so I've worked at Goldfields, it's in South Deep in the Western area. So I also worked at St. Gobain as a metallurgist, and I'm currently also working consulting for Transnet. And also at the University of Johannesburg as a lecturer. So I'm currently doing my PhD in chemical engineering, ideally focusing on renewable energy. Therefore, that's why we are now establishing a renewable energy startup company, which focuses on microbial fuel cells, which is a hydrogen derivative. So we specialize in generating electricity from domestic wastewater by the use of bacteria, which can be alternative sustainable solutions into solving the current Eskom crisis.
Wow. Okay, we'll get into that a little later on. Eh? Lastly, we're joined by a ghost guy today. We hardly ever have a ghost guy, but we've got a ghost guy. His name is Thembinkosi Khumalo, former Eskom employee and engineer. Am I correct?
Yes, correct. And as you said, I've worked like 90% of my career through Eskom generation. Rising through the ranks, of course. And I've also worked for Bechtel, which is an electricity generation company in Saudi Arabia. until recently, 2018, when I decided to go into business.
Oh, so you didn't get fired. You chose to leave.
No, I left.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's good to know. Gents, thank you so much for, you know, taking time out. I've been wanting to have this discussion for such a long time. And, you know, the premise here is just to find out, you know, what's going on. Because, like, everybody's in limbo. We don't know, you know. And maybe you guys can shed some light. And then also, let's talk about solutions. Like, what do we as a country, what can we do, you know? Because it's clear the government doesn't want to help us. But before we get into all of that, where does this crisis begin? Like, where did it start? And who's responsible for it? Like, why are we here?
Okay, maybe let me start trying to answer that question. I think that the source of the problem is that we didn't act quickly enough to build new power generation capacity. You know, as far back as 1998, 99, those early years, 2000, 2001, we were already talking to government at the time about the fact that we need to build new generation capacity, you know. And I mean, I was part of a team that went to Eskom, saying to Eskom that we know that you're going to have to build new generation capacity. But as entrepreneurs in the field, can you allocate some of the generation capacity to black engineers? Okay. And our idea, in fact, was very novel. Because at the time, what we're saying is that, look, this is a unique opportunity to create proper black industrialists. Okay. In the sense that in the power sector, only Eskom had been, you know, dominant. So there was no white company that was going to say, no, this black company must take 30% because we have experience in the, you know. You had a unique opportunity where Eskom could partner with black engineers who are entrepreneurs to create new industrialists who would then build, together with Eskom perhaps initially, build new generation capacity. And what our proposal was that we do that, build and own power stations jointly with Eskom, and then over time, we would buy Eskom's share out, you know, and then you have. So, and then Eskom obviously also made representations to government. The sad thing is that the decisions were never made until it was too late.
Huh.
Yeah, I think that's really the main source of the problem.
Sure. And according to you as an engineer?
Well, from my side, in retrospect, when we take it back, we need to understand the source of where it all comes from. So during the time when the Nationalist Party was ruling, they managed to invest in the infrastructure for energy security. So what happened during that period was that during the Nationalist Party, there was a fund that was created, which was called the CEFA, the Central Energy Fund Act. So within that specific fund, it had a policy whereby 16% of the GDP that the country was generating was invested in the infrastructure. Currently, we are looking at less than 1% of the GDP that's being invested in infrastructure. That's already setting us back decades away. On top of that, it then took obviously 40 years of operating those old power stations that were built. So in 1994, when the ANC then came into power, already they were in debt by 920 million. Then that's when they started saying, okay, we have a policy and so that we can make electricity a basic human right.
Right, yeah.
So what did that mean? That meant we need to expand, modernize, and obviously make sure that we give all the population electricity. Yeah. But now for us to do that, we needed funds. Mm. But where are we going to get the funds when already we're in a deficit of 920 million?
Mm.
That's where everything started to go wrong. We didn't have the expertise. The expertise came from the Van der Veel era expertise, who were advising the ANC guys, because the ANC guys didn't have the expertise. Mm. They had to source them out from the Nationalist Party, who were controlled by Van der Veil. That's why Megawatt Park is based in Van der Veil Park. Mm. So all of that was controlled ideally from the beginning, when Eskom there is now being ruled under the control of the ANC. Expertise were not there. The understanding was not there. The infrastructure as well was obviously, the project life cycle was around 40 years. Mm. And already all those power stations were now being depleted. So if we look at the future of what's about to happen now with Eskom, within the next 3 to 5 years, there'll be two power stations that will need to be decommissioned. Sure. And decommissioning those power stations simply means that there will be a reduction in supply of electricity. Mm. That reduction in supply of electricity simply means that we will not be able to meet the targets that we have to meet currently as we speak. Because at the moment, yes, we are saying we need to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions and etc. But in retrospect, we are, since 2012, we have produced 16 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. We haven't reduced anything yet, but yet we are still investing in renewable energies. But the investment is still small with regards to that. Only 1% of 1.4 trillion, which was invested last year, only came to Africa. And out of that 1%, 80% of that was only in seed and grant funding. So meaning there's no investment flowing into Eskom to help us alleviate the problem. So that's where the main root cause of the problem comes in.
Man, I regret asking you that question, man. Because it sounds like we're screwed. Tim, because having worked at Eskom, what's your take? What do you think?
All right. So the problem, according to me, begins by the year 1998. There's a current energy advisor to the president by the name Professor Anton Eberhard, who's a lecturer at the UCT School of Business. So Professor Eberhard writes a paper.
Sorry, why are you shaking your head?
No, it's because some of these advisors, I think, push agendas that don't take the country's
forward
interest into account.
Okay, I get you.
And in my view, he's one of them.
Oh, I get you. Okay.
Yeah. So Professor Eberhard writes a paper. It's called the White Paper, the Energy White Paper of 1998. And then the paper states that the government or Eskom will stop investing in generation capacity. And that additional capacity will come from the private investors. So Eskom decentralized what you call the planning team, because you had a team that will sit and plan for expansion of capacity for future. So that team is dismantled because the new investment generation fleet will come from private hands, according to the white paper. Now, what then happens here is the fact that the ANC government that had just taken in, they are busy adding load into the grid, because you must remember that Eskom, when Van der Beel founded it, Hendrik Van der Beel, it was designed to supply for the whites.
Yes,
let's face the facts. Yeah, it was designed to supply the whites. Mm. So there was no plan of capacity to say that it must accommodate the entire population of the country. So then the ANC government exercises the clause that says that they need to provide electricity to the people, and they start connecting people to the grid, but there is no plan in adding generation capacity. You are just adding this load into the existing fleet that you have, the installed capacity. And then starting your annual peak, your peak demands is normally like during winter, your highest peak, the time where you guys are all turning your stoves and
heaters
and all that, that particular time. The highest peak, they are recorded at Eskom. So they are, you check the annual that the growth at the peak, it's growing at this particular, let's say 1.5% compound factor. Now, if you project that, it projected that by the year 2007, the demand will determine supply, meaning that your installed capacity will be lower than your demand, and you will have a problem with it. Now, Eskom approaches the then deputy president, who was, of course, in charge of the economic structures of the country, Thabo Mbeki, the former president. And they approached him to say that, look, by the year 2007, the installed capacity will be lower than the demand, so we need to build. Then Thabo Mbeki references the white paper of Anton Eberhard that no private sector will do that. So we will not focus on that as government. Oh. Then Eskom focuses. Then 2004, Allan Ewick, he was the public enterprise minister at the time. He then approaches Eskom because he can see that something is happening. And then he's like, you projected that by the year 2007, the installed capacity will be lower than the demand. Mm. Is that still going to happen? Then they say yes. And then he's like, no, we need to build.
Huh.
Now, that's what led to the technical faults that you find in Medupi and Gusile, because there was no time to design.
Huh.
Eskom had to be from design to placing contracts and to be on site with bulldozers in 24 months.
Sure.
So what then happened?
And normally, how much time would you need?
You need a minimum of 6 years.
6 years,
yes, because you speak of your first designs, or your chemical processes, your process plant, your flow, and all that, and then you go to mechanical designs, and then it's your electrical fleet and designs and red line drawings, your PNIDs, and all that. They didn't have that time, so the best thing was to take the latest power stations to be built by Eskom, which was Majuba Power Station, then try and retrofit the design to expand it to an 800 megawatts. But now they only expanded the mechanical design, not the process, because if you check at the technical problems in Medupi, they are related to processes, to the process design. It's your flow, it's your temperatures into your dust plant are excessive, so you need to reduce your load in order for you to keep the unit afloat and not trip it. So that's the problem that you have there. It's chemical design problems. So. And then now you're starting to what you call to build, of course. But then we were facing the World Cup in 2010, right?
Oh yeah.
So which means that we didn't need to have these problems.
Mm.
So Zuma makes a critical decision of saying that we're going to what you call to return to service certain power stations that were mothballed. So there were power stations that were decommissioned back in the day. So there was a Grootvlei power station, a Camden power station in Emelo, Henrina power station, and Nkomati power station. So those four power stations, it decides that we're going to invest about 32 billion in this, and then we're going to return them to service. They were refurbished, overhauled, world-class technologies. And I think the systems at Grootvlei are better than the systems at Kusile currently. Mm. I can tell you that. Mm. So they are returned to service, and then they are connected to the grid. They started coming in, I think, from June 27, 2008. Hence, in 2008, you had a glitch of load shedding. Not much, but it was quickly solved because those power stations were then adding capacity to the grid.
Mm.
And then the load shedding problem was solved at that particular moment. Then 2014, again, you had a problem. And the problem in 2014 was caused because there's a silo that collapsed at Majuba Power Station, taking out 3,600 megawatts. But it was fixed in 6 months, and load shedding was gone. Now, after Majuba, Ingula Power Station, which is a pump station in Ladysmith, comes in on load with an addition of 1,700 megawatts. Medupi Unit 6 comes in, though it had problems, but it was still adding over 500 megawatts into the grid. Medupi 3, Medupi 4. In fact, Medupi, I was still there when the last unit came on load in 2018. August 24 at 1700, the last unit of Medupi came on load. So Medupi is fully commissioned.
Mm.
I hear people always making excuses, it's behind schedule. No, it's fully commissioned, that station. So with the addition of 4,000 megawatts that is coming in from Medupi, the addition of another 2,100 currently from Kusile because it's not complete, and the 1,700 of Ingula, you shouldn't be speaking about load shedding in South Africa.
What? Are you being serious?
I'm being serious. You shouldn't be speaking about load shedding in South Africa. When we go on, I will tell you why we are where we are. But with the coming in of Medupi, the coming in of Kusile, and the coming in of Ingula, you shouldn't be speaking about load shedding in this country.
You wanted to add something?
I'm aware of the fact that maybe the audience might not understand some of the many technical
things. Yes.
So I just wanted to simplify something that he said. So when he said that what Eskom did was to take some of the old designs of Majuba to 800 megawatts. So the Majuba units are 600, right? 670 megawatts. So they were going to use bigger units, which are 800 megawatts. And so they took those designs and just retrofitted them. But when you do that, there are other systems that you have to also upgrade. It's like if you have an engine that is a 6-cylinder.
100%.
And then you put an 8-cylinder engine. That car is going to have more power, but then you must upgrade your brakes.
And everything else.
And everything else. So that's what didn't happen. That led to some of the design problems that we experienced. And that's the problem why some of these new power stations are not, especially Kusile, are not operating.
Properly. It's 2023. We still have load shedding. Yeah. But can you guys explain to like a three-year-old, what is load shedding? Like what is actually happening when we don't have electricity? Like from, well, what's going on? Like,
Do you wanna?
Yeah, sure. So in layman's terms, electricity, it's basically the balance between the supply and the demand. So it simply means that the amount of electricity that's being supplied does not meet the amount of demand that's required by ordinary citizens. So with that in place, how you would ideally break it down is that, yes, you would say, for instance, you have a glass of full water, 100% full. So within that specific glass, there is some consumption of electricity that's being wasted, right, within the peak demand. So there's peak demand that's being put in there. There's maintenance. There's obviously sometimes you need to use your diesel, and sometimes we don't get 100% excess of diesel all the time. So that also puts us at the back foot. So when that happens within the overall aspect of the energy security, that hinders, number one, the national security. Because when there's load shedding, we are affected by energy security. National security is affecting us. The economy is being affected. The social aspect of it is being affected. So in retrospect, the triple bottom line effect of economics, the social, and also the population counter factors also plays into part with reference to load shedding in Eskom's regard. So when you try to deep dive into the whole aspect of things, we need to go back to the root cause of where Eskom is coming from. So we need to understand the whole supply chain of electricity. It all starts from the mining sector, right? So as we start from the mining sector, we need to understand that currently, we have not reached an equilibrium point whereby we can outcast fossil fuels or coal in that respect. We cannot, because if we say we're going to outcast fossil fuels, that simply means the mining towns where these mines are allocated, those regions, those villages are not going to be employed. People are going to starve. Employment rate is going to go up. So obviously, the logistics of transporting the coal to those power stations is going to be affected as well. So in retrospect, the overall supply chain land for us to have light has a lot of factors that it needs to come into play. So we need to mainly focus on three major pillars. The three pillars that we need to focus on is infrastructure. The current infrastructure that we have is an infrastructure that's supported by fossil fuels. The reason why I'm saying that is because when you look at your piping, you need oil supply, diesel supply through pipes. You need shipping to ship in the petroleum gas, as well as you need railroads to transport whatever chemicals that you would need. That's when our Transnet comes into play. The second pillar would obviously be your policies and regulations, which also need to take into consideration. The third pillar will be a well-skilled workforce. So all of those three pillars need to work together So there needs to be a cross-border and a cross-sector interaction between all of those three pillars for this overall chain of supply to actually work. Although, yes, we understand there's some aluminium smelters in South Africa, whereby we know currently the current price of electricity per kilowatt hours around 2 rand 12 cents. Mm. But there are aluminium smelters in South Africa, which I will not mention names, who are paying 17 cents per kilowatt hour. And we know that aluminium smelters are high producers or high consumers, rather, of energy. So when that happens, clearly there is some form of favor that's been happening to those aluminium smelters. Yes, we can take them away because we need the manufacturing of aluminium ingots to produce whatever technologies that we need to have for renewable energies or for other technologies that can supply electricity. Mm. When you then break down that overall three pillars that we have, number one, we need to be ambitious within our plans. The government needs to have solid plans. It needs to have solid targets and goals that we need to encounter. Institutions need to also play a part. I like what President Cyril Ramaphosa did by creating new ministries. That's one of the key main factors that need to happen for us to have a good transition and alleviate the load shedding. New ministries need to happen, which is a good sign since now we have a Minister of Electricity. I was very much excited when we saw that because that shows that there is a vision, there is an ambition that's actually happening there, as well as also the physical infrastructure. Yes, we know that we cannot build new infrastructure because it will take around 6 to 10 years. Mm. But now, how do we use the existing infrastructure supplemented with new technologies to increase the power capacity onto the grid? That also needs to be taken into consideration. A good example would be wastewater treatment plants. So when you look at wastewater treatment plants, there's around 850 wastewater treatment plants, both publicly owned and privately owned. So within those treatment plants, there is over 11.2 terawatts of power, potential power, that's in dirty water, the bacteria that are in there. But there's no technologies that are being focused to actually extract the amount of electricity or energy that's in there. And these are already existing infrastructures that you can utilize. But yes, we are talking about PVs, we are talking about wind, we are talking about other technologies. But when we focus on those technologies need new infrastructures. They need a consumption of land. Mm. That consumption of land then puts us on a back foot because now our population is growing. Mm. So now there's a contradiction between the two. We are consuming land to produce this amount of electricity, but now population is growing. What's going to happen moving forward? Rather, let's use existing infrastructures, supplement them with new existing technologies, produce the electricity moving forward. So those are the breakdown of the three pillars that we have. Together with the skilled workforce, yes, I would understand, okay, the guys at Eskom that are working in fossil fuels, they would be saying, okay, but what's going to happen to our jobs? Mm. If now we close down Eskom and we're focusing on wind, solar, because you only need a few people to maintain that, what's going to happen to those jobs? We should have a clear target and a clear roadmap to say we need to create a pathway, a career pathway between the fossil fuel guys moving into the renewable energy guys. That pathway needs to happen. We need to train those people. We need to change the way the curriculum is being operated from a high school perspective all the way to university, to job recruiters, so this can be allowed into the renewable energy sector. That overall aspect of what's happening there, that will create new opportunities. Mm. If that does not happen, I mean, just on the 23rd of February this year, did you know that the PVs that have been installed in South Africa currently, they have actually reduced in power generation. Oh. We have not increased power generation. We have actually reduced power generation by those PVs that are actually being built currently as we stand. So that's the deficit that we're currently facing, which also puts the investor guys into perspective. Mm. They need to change their perspective as well. We need to have a different types of investments coming in. We need to have different volumes of investments that need to come in. this 1% of us getting funding from COP28 or COP27, 1 trillion, and we're only getting 1% of the 1 trillion. Mm. And that's Africa in general. Mm. I've not been breaking down the countries. 85% of the amount of money that's being flown within the renewable energy sectors is going to only three regions and cities, I mean countries. It's the USA, it's China, and it's the European Union. Oh. And they are building 85% of PVs and wind that are putting addition power capacity into the overall global grid, which was 295 gigawatts. And that was only those three. South Africa, less than 10%, has been added. So
sure. And TK, I wanted to ask you, man, how come some suburbs don't get load shedded? Like, there's some places where they don't get load shedded.
Okay, no, but...
yeah.
No, it depends. Some you've got the institutions that are protected by the national key point, right? Like your hospitals.
Mm.
If you're living in an area that is supplied with the same distribution grid boxes as that of the hospital, so you will not get affected because people's lives are at stake in there. There are places, some of them we can't name them, where uranium is being stored. You know the uranium that was melted in the nuclear bombs
back in the 90s,
stored somewhere. So that area must always have power. So that area is normally protected. So yeah, I know that
it's Spain City, one of those areas. You guys have uranium.
So to answer this question of load shedding, what is load shedding? Basically, it's simple, MFG.
Yeah.
You cannot meet demand.
That's it.
That's it. Yeah. You are failing to meet demand and to protect the grid then, because if we're saying that the demand is sitting, let's say, at 28,000 a megawatt, and the capacity that we have is sitting at 27,000 megawatts, and we decide not to load shed.
Mm.
What's going to happen the moment all the grids is the equipment is drawing from the grid? You turn on your geysers and all that. You'll have a blackout because you are synchronizing these things at a certain frequency. There's a certain harmonic that you're synchronizing these generators. The moment it spikes up or down, it's out. It's a blackout, and you don't want to find yourself in that situation. So to protect the equipment and the grid, you decide to say that let's reduce the what you call the load to meet the amount that we have.
No, makes sense.
Yeah, we will protect this.
Let's talk about the comrades. Rumors have it comrades are looting. They're making money from this. That's why they don't want a solution. What's your take?
Hey, you know, on that one, I can't really comment.
Mm.
Okay. The reason being that I would be speculating.
Mm.
Okay. It's obviously a widespread rumor.
Mm.
And definitely some of it is happening.
Mm. Okay.
But as to exactly who and all of that, I couldn't really give you details.
I mean, there was an article that was mentioning cartels that are involved in this. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Yeah.
Mm.
I didn't read the article, but I read write-ups about that article.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what do you think about the looting?
I mean, it's feasible that the looting is happening across the Eskom value chain. The main reason why is when you have a holistic point of view and you think about it, Eskom subcontracts certain companies, right, within the overall supply chain. So when we take it from the beginning, as stage one, from the mining side, Eskom needs a supply of coal from these specific mines.
Mm.
So there are certain mines, there's a policy within Eskom that there are certain mines that have a high calorific value of coal. They are first priority. And Eskom is willing to fund those specific mines because the quality of coal that they are using to be converted into coke, which has been used in Eskom generation for those turbines, that amount of money is being directed to those specific mines because of their coal. right? So obviously, when you look at the geoscience, they have information on geoscience. So they know, okay, in geoscience, the Waterberg region or the Springbok region, they have good quality coal.
So basically, the more load shedding,
The more money they make.
Oh, makes sense.
The more money they make, there will be more load shedding. The more load shedding, there will be more money. Because now, if they alleviate load shedding, then there won't be any form of looting that will actually happen there.
Yes, yes.
There's also certain internal sabotages that do happen. So what one example could be the gearboxes that are operating at Eskom. You get people that are there that are being hired to actually ruin those gearboxes,
yes.
Break glasses. Then from them breaking those specific glasses, what then happens? A maintenance job cut needs to come out. That's more money for them. So when that maintenance job cut comes out, they'll give, okay, for 1 year, you need to maintain this. Do you think if I fix this specific generator and I know the maintenance will be for 10 years, am I going to keep on fixing it?
No.
Or am I just going to leave it there until I'm going to leave it there so that I can always continuously renew the specific contracts so that I can keep on eating.
It's just like potholes. If you fix the potholes,
then what? She won't eat anymore.
Yeah. I want to move on to another, I don't know if it's a conspiracy or a rumor, of the fact that all of this is happening because they want to privatize Eskom. What's your take, TK?
No, I agree. I agree with that. The main aim of this load shedding is to create a shortage so that you can sign additional IPPs which benefit cronies. That's how I see it. Because I did say that, I will tell you why you're having load shedding. One is that you spend money returning powers, what you call power plants to service. That I counted Rodfly, I counted Camden, I counted Henry. Currently, if you go to Rodfly Power Station, you have 6 units, right? Each is about 200 megawatts. So it's a 1,200 megawatt station. So you'll only find that there are 3 units that are running. The other 3 are not running. A reason being, of course, is that the operating expenditure to the power station managers. So if a unit of a plant, be it a pump, be it a turbine, you have what you call in what you call it Eskom maintenance, a philosophy that the turbine leads and the boiler follows, right? That at 9,000 running hours, you must open your low pressure turbines and then you do a maintenance on that. And then the boiler also has a scope in that particular things. At 50,000 megawatts, running hours, you open up your generator. You call that a general overhaul, where you're overhauling the whole unit. So this notion that power stations are old, there's nothing old in engineering, because if this turbine, I'm refurbishing it and I'm replacing these blades and I'm replacing the rotor in 50,000, if this turbine was 30 years old and I'm replacing the rotor at the end of 30 years, is it still 30 years old or have I renewed it? So you've renewed this particular turbine. So that's what happened. Derated didn't issue operating expenditure, and then the machines ran beyond their allowance factor or safety factor. Then he decided to say that the engineers, of course, we are guided by the Sydney and Dublin Accords of engineering, to say that you cannot allow it to run beyond this. And then you shut it down. You say, until you give me maintenance budget, I'm going to shut it down.
Yeah.
So the units have been off. So meaning that what you call the installed capacity has been reduced. That's what it means. Because you have reduced it by 600 megawatts at Rodfly Power Station. You have reduced it by 1,400 megawatts at Camden Power Station. You have reduced it by another 1,400 megawatts at Hendrina Power Station. So in total, you've got about, and then there's Duva Unit 3 that has not been attended to. You've got Medupi 4. You know, if you return these units that I'm counting on, you have a 6,000 megawatts that you're going to plug into the grid. And you know what does 6,000 megawatts mean? It means that stage 6 load shedding is gone, because when you speak about stage 1, that is 1,000 megawatts. So you've got 6,000 megawatts. That is off intentionally because someone decided to take money and go and plug it in areas where it was not wanted. And people celebrated that I don't want to call it nonsense, but that arrangement, they celebrated that. So that's the problem. So The problem in South Africa, like I said, I will agree with that conspiracy to say that the aim is to privatize.
So here's, we've spoken about how it started. We've spoken about what the problem is. I want to speak about a solution, and a solution that doesn't involve the government, because it just sounds like it's all politics, right? So I want to ask, as South African citizens, how can we come up with the solution? Like, what can we do? Because I know there's a friend of mine who stays at a complex. They sent out an email and they were like, listen, if there's any engineers that stay in this complex, please let's meet so you can assist us with this load shedding thing. What can we do? They came up with a solution. I don't know what it is, but literally within 3 months, they're going to be off the grid.
And that's the thing. with that, if I take you, if you're bringing a solution as citizen, it's individual solution, like you speak of that. They say that they will be off the grid, probably, but they will never be off the grid. Let me be clear with that. They will never be off the grid. They can say that they will reduce their load from the grid, what they draw.
So there's nothing we can do as citizens?
No, but because when you say that you are off the grid, it simply means that I'm cutting off the Eskom cable.
Yeah.
So you go like we're going into winter right now, a week without what you call without a sun, because I can tell you that solution relies on PV. You go a week without a sun, where are you going to get your power? Because solar and wind, they are backed by something. Now, there's a technology that Eskom is bringing in, which is called the battery energy storage system, the BESS, which simply means that while you generate, you are able to store some of these things so that you are able to dispatch it at night. But the gap is around 80 megawatt hours, so which is roughly 4 hours, meaning you'll be able to dispatch about 4 hours from sunset. So as citizen, you can only bring an individual solution to your household and whatever, but not the overall saying that you're going to, because it's a very expensive business, MacG. You can say that we need to do a gas to power. I've done a couple of those, but I cannot be mentioning my clients. For example, Cape Town International, there is a 10 megawatt gas to power that we did in there. So where you're converting gas, biogas into power, so you're using gas turbines and then you supply. It's a base load power. That kind of one. But it's expensive. So it means that we need to invest billions as a country, as individual, citizens. We create a fund, MeTrust account, where we donate and then we get these billions and we are able to purchase this equipment. And then we can assist with the designs.
How much are we looking at? How many billions would that be?
We can do, for 10 megawatts, you're looking at around 600 million. So if you're saying you're going for 1,000 megawatt, you're not looking at anything less than 40 billion.
Benny, I know you've got the solutions, my man. These guys, they still want their tenders, I can hear. Benny, what do you think, man?
To be honest and fair, in my view and my perspective is that we need to do a deep dive into planning, do a deep dive into modernization of all the current infrastructure, the power stations that are currently operating. We also need to do an expansion into different technologies within the renewable energy space. I'm not against fossil fuel. I'm not against nuclear. But for us to increase capacity or expand on capacity on nuclear or build new nuclear plants, I mean, that will take us probably 10 years to do that. That will require much more investments into that space as well. If we are then also focusing on having favors to be done by our own government to say, look, we want to accelerate energy production within the overall system, this will obviously need an influx of a supply of fossil fuel. So that influx of supply of fossil fuel, ideally, in what is needed in the COP21 policy regulations, which was set by the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, which was set back in 2015 in COP21. We are going to be penalized based on that. And us being penalized, will be penalized on the carbon tax finance principle that we are ideally looking to be penalized on. But now the solutions that need to happen needs to be a diversification of certain solutions that are immediate solutions that need to happen now, right? So solutions that need to happen now are innovative solutions that still need to happen. I mean, there's a lot of innovative solutions that are there.
I want to move on to questions that I've got from Chillers. If you know anyone wants to answer these questions, more than welcome. Let's just keep it as brief as possible, no? Because of time. Why do NGOs, why are they so invested in our energy decisions?
That's one of the problems, MacG. The NGOs are the problem in this country, in this energy process. Currently, they are challenging the Richards Bay gas 2,000 megawatts gas plant. You know, if you construct that gas power station in Richards Bay, that 2,000 megawatts, you've reduced actually the country load shedding by 2,000 megawatts because the smelters in the Richards Bay area will be supplied via that gas power station. And therefore, you've taken them off the grid, meaning that 2,000 megawatts that they were consuming is coming to the people of South Africa. But NGOs are there. Like the solution, the immediate solution, I hear people are speaking about renewables. We've been signing bid window 1, bid window 2, bid window 3. We've been signing these IPPs. How many of them are connected to the grid? I can tell you, it's Avon. The one in Porth Adda, what's the name of that power station? I just forgot the name, the one in Porth Adda, the concentrated solar plant. Yeah. Those are the only two that are connected. The rest are not connected, but you've been signing them. You know why? They are not dispatchable. They are not readily available to dispatch and solve problems. So when you're signing them, you're speaking in a space of 5 to 10 years of them coming on load. I hear it speaking about nuclear will take 10 years to construct. Even these IPPs, they are not available. They're not available. It's not dispatchable power that I'm signing in tomorrow you're able to supply me. They are not there. The NGOs are a problem because currently I can tell you that the solution is to bring in what you call the floating storage regasification unit, the FSRUs, what you would know them from media called the power ships that they are against so much. Bring the FSRUs, say contract about 3,000 megawatts for about 18 months or so. You connect them in Richards Bay, Kuha, in the East London port, and then you plug them onto the grid. And then you say to Eskom, I've relieved you of 3,000 megawatts. Can you do proper maintenance into these units that are off and return them to service? In 18 months, those units will be back on load, and load shedding is gone forever. From there.
Let's move on to the next question. The president recently stated that the constitution does not oblige government to provide electricity. Benny, what do you think about that statement?
With regards to that statement, I mean, it depending on the perspective in which you look at it in, it can go either left or it can either go to the right. So in my perspective is that what the current president is trying to do, right? He's trying to actually benefit the country in both sides. So the first side would ideally be, since now we are overall part of the 195 countries that have signed the agreement, the Paris Agreement of 2015 at COP21, ideally, we also need to focus on the perspective that within the renewable energy side, right, there is certain things that we are not being told, right? One of the things is that, yes, we understand that fossil fuel, or rather, let me put in this, coal in this aspect, is obviously a depleting resource. It's not an unlimited resource. So we need to source out new resources. So where do those resources come from? Those new resources come from what we call our rare earth elements, and there are 17 of those. So out of those 17 rare earth elements, each and every single country out of the 195 countries that are there, they have a specific element that they need to mine. Currently, I can take Zambia for example. They have produced over, since the dawn of Jesus till today, we've produced around 800 billion to around 1 trillion tons of copper, right, that has been produced. We need to produce that amount between today and 2050. That's around within 30 years from now. We need to produce the same amount of copper that has been produced from the dawn of Jesus till today within a space of 30 years. That's how much copper that is to happen. The amount of copper that's needed now within the space of renewable energy is four times the amount of copper that's being used in ordinary cars that are being used at the present moment. So that ideally then puts us at a good perspective that you can then ideally see an exponential growth when you look at those specific factors, because now we're going to go into what we call a super cycle, a minerals resource super cycle of those specific elements. And those specific elements can be obviously outsourced from our current power stations. So by the use of fly ash, we can then extract an element called cerium. That specific element, cerium, can actually be used in windows, electric vehicles, and also your display that you see in your cars, the red, blue display that you see. Those are not lights. Those are elements that are being resourced out. So ideally, in retrospect, what the president is doing is trying to benefit both sides of the party. Mm. One side being, yes, let's do an energy transition, but within that energy transition, there's certain elements that need to be resourced. At the same time, we're not forgetting on what's happening on the right-hand side, because there still needs to be a balance between the two transitions. There's a whole deep dive when you look at the onset, the beginning of where everything comes from. All of this comes from a monetary perspective. Mm. If fossil fuel gets finished, what other industrial revolution is going to take place? This industrial revolution that needs to take place is happening on these 17 rare earth elements that are currently being sourced out at the present moment.
So it's safe to say you don't agree with that his statement?
I 100% don't.
Okay. Next question. What is the role of different government departments, DMRE, Electricity Minister, DPE, and DFFE? You want to take that, comrade?
Not really. Because I think it's all confused.
Mm.
Yeah. You see, we have DMRE now, and we used to have DMRE, then it was split to minerals and energy, mm. and then they were put together again, and now we're creating Ministry of
Electricity.
And we've got DPE, which is supposedly in charge of Eskom. So this creates huge problems, from a policy perspective. And from the point of view of these entities that are supposed to do their work and provide the infrastructure that they... Well, if you're Eskom, who are you accountable to? Is it DPE? Is it Department of Minerals and Energy? Who are you exactly? Are you accountable to? So there needs to be a rationalization of that whole thing, so that it's simpler and it works for South Africa.
All right, last question. What is our position on the JET IP? I think you've answered that, no? Someone's answered that.
Just energy transition.
Yeah.
We spoke a little bit about it, yeah.
Do you want to add some more?
Yeah, no, you just need to postpone this just energy transition. Guys, we can. We are not against renewables, but we are saying that let's be realistic. We can bring them in, because currently what is happening, these renewables, they cannot even meet the speed of the frequency. If you go and check, there's a court case where they are trying to take NERSA to court to say that NERSA must reduce the standard of the grid so that they are able to connect. I mean, South Africa's grid was not designed for such. Mm-hmm. You want to make us another Nigeria where a grid trips every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. We don't want that. So for you to do that, it means that you must invest in what you call the smart grids. Are microgrids that are focusing on certain areas. Say in the Randburg area, you have a 50 megawatts plant, solar plant. Then you create a microgrid that will supply the area. Then you can speak about that. But in this current moment, we need to postpone the just energy transition. And it's us who committed, by the way. No one was what you call came to say, South Africa, you must decommission your coal stations and your nuclear. It's us who committed to that. I don't know informed by what, but it's South Africa who did that.
Just a quick addition. You know, McG, renewables have their place. Okay, we're not saying that they have their place. And we need to have a proper mix. But what's happening in South Africa is that we are pushing them beyond their place, if you know what I mean. And I think over time, all of these technologies will mature, you know, and they maybe some of the problems that we're talking about will be taken care of. Okay. But right now, there are far too many problems for us to say, to solve the serious problems that we have. And if we want to industrialize as a nation, we should be using renewables, you see. I often give this example. Do you know that cars, the first cars that were built, okay, used to travel at like 9 kilometers an hour? That is slower than a marathon run. The guy who wins the comrades runs faster than those cars. But the technology was at its initial stages. Okay. And over time, it evolved to being a mature technology. Okay. So what we're saying is that don't try to push technologies to do things that they are incapable of doing, at least at this point in time. You know, it would be like trying to get that car that was running at 9 kilometers to you put it in a Formula One. There's no hope in hell.
I think we understand that.
So the just energy, so the introduction of renewable technologies should happen. I'm an engineer. I love new technologies, and we all do, you know. But we need to be responsible.
And realistic.
And realistic about how we introduce them.
All right. I want to wrap this up. Once again, thank you so much, guys, for taking time out for this conversation. I mean, for me, it was really fruitful. In closing, as citizens, like, what can we do, like, in terms of how long is this still going to be around for? Like, how can I, as a normal citizen, prepare myself for the next few years that are about to come?
So with the current situation we are in with load shedding, it's in my view, when I was looking at the IRENA report, the International Renewable Energy Agency report, the World Outlook, there's a high-level deep dive research paper that was released. Ideally, for the next 12 years, in my perspective, in South Africa, we will still be experiencing load shedding if we do not have an immediate solution to that, right? That within the next 12 years, it's not going to decrease anyway, right? So the issue with that reference is that for us to then have ideally a solution in retrospect to solve all of this problem or try to solve all of this problem, it's... which I always give emphasis on, you need to inject heavy, heavy amounts of volume of investments within the overall energy sector. You need to inject the amounts of investments. That has to happen. We cannot sit down and say, oh, no, our budget is 500 billion or whatnot. No, no. We need to have a budget of around maybe close to 5 trillion globally per annum within the overall transition that has to happen. So... With that being said, there are solutions that can happen. We have the brain power. We have the brain capacity. We have the research institutions. We have the new technologies and solutions to have an overall solution to the overall problem that's been happening currently in South Africa and globally as well.
And you, sir? What do you think, sir?
The technology is there to solve the load shedding problem. The problem is not the engineering or the technology. The problem is people. And I haven't seen plans either from DMRE or from the new Minister of Electricity that show conclusively that we will get rid of load shedding in the next 24 months. Okay. What TK was talking about is something we did draw up a plan as IFSA on how we could get rid of load shedding. One, as we said, we put those, let's call them car power ships. You could also use nuclear ones. And we hook them up, Richards Bay, PE, and maybe East London or Saldanha. 1,000 megawatts each, you relieve the country of 3,000 megawatts. There's three stages of load shedding out like that. You don't have to build them or anything. You just have to put the infrastructure to connect to the next transmission substations, you know? And that is something that can happen very quickly. But in order to do that, you would need to have this state of emergency that's just been cancelled. Because what's going to happen is that these NGOs that you were talking about would immediately block this thing from happening. And unfortunately, they're holding the country into ransom. So bring those car power ships, then relieve Eskom so that, and inject money into Eskom so that they bring back the units that are not operational at the moment. And that would quickly, within 24 months, load shedding would be gone. In fact, it would be reduced within 6 to 12 months if you brought in the floating power vessels. And then in the long term, you bring back the Eskom units that are not operational. And then in the long term, you build the power stations like I was saying.
TK, and according to you, what can we brace ourselves for the next few years to come?
MXG, if I'm honest with you, currently, I had hope when Spootler came in as the new electricity minister. But after the recent interviews that I had, it looks like it doesn't have a solution as well. Because the only thing is speaking private this and private that. And trust me, a solution does not lie in private hands. The solution lies within the government. So according to me, you can stop this load shedding in 24 months if you bring the floating storage regasification unit, the FSRUs, bring them, and then you relieve Eskom so that they have time to do maintenance in the current units. And then they return them to service. Once they return them to service, and you can also increase investment in the Kaora Basa hydro plant in Mozambique, because we are currently importing 1,200 megawatts from Mozambique in that Kaora Basa. And that plant has got a capacity to generate over 9,000 megawatts, right? Which is the water that I said we don't have. So we can have an agreement with the government of Mozambique to increase the capacity of that Kaora Basa. And then we say that we can. Because currently they are generating about 2,800 and we are taking 1.2 because we invested in that and the rest is supplying Mozambique. So we can say that we want to increase the generating of this to 9,000 and then we will leave you with, say, 4,000. We're going to take the rest of 5,000 megawatts. We increase that. And then you return to service the units that are off. And then you plan on building, by just returning to service, like I'm saying, the units that are off currently, you are bringing 6,000 megawatts. Kubek 2, which is currently off on outage, will bring 900 megawatts on the 27th of July. It will be coming back on load. So it will bring another 900. So you've got about 7,000 megawatts that will be additional to the grid.
Why didn't you tell them this when you were at Eskom?
When I was at Eskom, we didn't have load shedding. we didn't have load shedding. We had an excess capacity of 3,000 megawatts. Where you actually negotiating with Namibian Power and the BPC, the Botswana Power Corporate, to sell the power to them because we had excess capacity. It means we had cars in the garage so that when this specific car is breaking down, we are able to call another car and say, run and be on load at this particular time. And we didn't have load shedding.
And then what happens when, during the EFF March, there's no load shedding at all?
You're burning diesel. You're burning diesel. That's what happened. You're burning diesel. And they are overusing that Uncle Peck station, those gas power stations, because they are not...
Wait, explain that. So what happened? What happens when there's no load shedding on a day like that? What happens?
No, you're burning diesel. That's what you do. So that they keep your mouth shut. That's what they did there.
Oh! Yeah.
So they're burning diesel, like I'm saying. Then they are overusing those gas turbines because they are not designed to be base load station. They are designed to be peak station. Like, they should supplement the grid when it's 5 o'clock and MacG wants to cook and KG wants to take a shower. They should be coming in on load, supplementing the grid, and they should run for that specific hour, say about 4 hours, and then you run them back again in the morning, in the peak hours of the morning. They're not supposed to be base load like they are doing right now, running them 24/7. They're not supposed to be that, those gas power station. So they are finishing them up.
You understand the concepts of base load, peaking, and all of that?
Yeah.
So different generation plants are built for certain modes of operation. Okay. Base load, basically, you build it, you run it flat. Mm. It runs, it's like a car that runs at constant speed, long distance. Okay. And then you get what we call mid-merit stations. Those are the ones that generate a power during the day when the demand goes up a little bit from after the morning peak up to the evening peak. Then you get peaking stations, okay? And the one you was talking about is a peaking station, okay? They are open cycle gas turbines. You can also use a combined cycle gas turbines. So they come in only during the peaks to help to feed in more power, to help you. So in the morning peak and in the evening peak. But they're expensive to run. This is why I was saying they're burning diesel. They run on diesel. They're expensive to run. So you don't run them 24/7. If you do that, you run out of money.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what they were doing to keep people shut so that they don't participate in the...
That's crazy. Benny, man, in closing, anything else you want to add?
So what I would like to add would be that we need to ideally have a holistic point of view as to how we're going to tackle the current situation that we're in. We need to have, yes, an immediate plan. We also need to have a holistic view, decade plan, which ideally needs to have a deep dive and put a cross-border, cross-sector, interdisciplinary interaction between different industries and put all of those together to solving the specific problem that we have. A reference to that would ideally be if people will start looking into the International Renewable Energy Agency reports, that will ideally give you a holistic view as to where we are, why renewable energy was introduced, how does renewable energy benefit, and how is climate change, rather, in retrospect, affecting the overall transition that we are actually in at the present moment. And also one question that a lot of people, or rather answer that a lot of people don't know the question to, would be this global warming issue that we are talking about. What is global warming and how does global warming actually come about? A lot of people, to be honest, do not know. Mm. Yes, we know, okay, global warming, yes, the world is getting warm and all of that. But how is that actually happening? A lot of people, it's not given out in public knowledge. Mm. It's literally, most of the knowledge that's there, it's in private institution knowledge of how global warming is actually coming about and how do we actually have that increase in temperature within the overall globe. How does that happen? How does these gas, greenhouse gas emissions that are being emitted increase the amount of temperature that's within the overall globe? A lot of people do not understand the science or the theory behind that. So how does it happen? All we know is, okay, I'm burning fossil fuel, I have global warming. But what causes that increase in temperature? How do those gases increase?
And you don't know. You don't have the answer.
I do. I know.
Okay.
So what ideally happens, the greenhouse gas emissions that are being emitted are carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide majority, right? So when these gases now being emitted into the air, they are being oxidized. So the formation of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, when it reacts with oxygen, right, which is in the air, 21% of air is made up of oxygen, the rest is nitrogen. So when it reacts with that, the process reaction formation, it's called oxidation. Mm. So that oxidation that forms carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, thermodynamically, it's called an exothermic reaction, meaning it releases heat. So when we emit those CO2 gases and the carbon monoxide gases, the formation reaction of those gases, they are exothermic, meaning they release heat. That heat that's being released gets released into the atmosphere, meaning there'll be an increase in temperature. That's where global warming actually comes into play, because of the exothermic reactions that are actually happening within the process reaction formations of those gases.
Oh, that sounds complicated, dog. Yo. I'm shining up.
Exothermic. You can go and look it up.
Comrade Mtunzi, your last words, what do you want to say?
You know, I just want to say that we need the right people in government. Okay. Any modern economy, and when I say right people, I'm talking from, you know, many aspects. Mm. Obviously, we need ethical people there. Mm. We need people who are properly qualified and to do the work that needs to be done. Mm. And we need people who are hardworking. Okay. But I just want to quickly focus on the issue of properly qualified people. Any modern economy has a lot of infrastructure in it. You know, we have ports, we have pipelines, we have roads, there's electricity, we have refineries, and we have telecommunication networks and all of these things. In fact, a modern economy cannot operate without infrastructure. Mm. And yet, in our government, we don't have technically qualified people. This new Minister of Electricity, is the only one. And he's a bit misplaced because I think he qualified as a civil engineer and he's working in an electricity environment. But at least he's an engineer. If we don't do that, our infrastructure will continue to crumble. If you look at China, the last three ministers of China, presidents of China, including the current one, they are all engineers. China used to have more than 70% of their cabinet as either scientists or engineers. That's why it's this developed now. You know, in 1960, Africa was at the same level of development as China. Mm, mm. Now, China is at least surpassed 40 years ahead of us.
100%.
You know, that's one of the reasons. You know, and we keep putting people in there who don't know anything. Simple things. A minister of public works should be a technically qualified person. Minister of energy should be somebody who's an expert in energy, etc., etc. Mm. If we don't do that, we'll continue to slide down.
And I agree with you. I think we need to get all you old guys out of the government. We need to run the country now, for sure.
Where they must go. We need Penny, we need TK. You know what I mean?
What about me?
You are not make sure, you. Man, your time is up. You know what I mean, Benny? Let us run the country,
that's
man.
True.
Like, haven't
that's
you looted enough money? Like, come on, guys.
I haven't looted anything, and I'll never loot, by the way.
Yeah. No, that's good to know. TK, any last closing?
No, I think on the last closing, when I'm actually, I'll agree. The first question that you asked was, what should citizens do is to hold government accountable. Government accounts to us as citizens. And that's what you should do. Currently, you just accept that you are told that you'll be on stage for load shedding. And you're not given a plan to say that at least you must endure this stage 2 load shedding for this long because we are currently doing APNC 100%. To fix that. We just accept. Stage 2. It's increased stage 4. And then we move on. And that is where our mistake is. You should hold government accountable.
Tell me something. How come in telecommunications there's MTN, Cell C, all these guys, but with energy, it's just Eskom?
Even in telecommunications, you must remember that they've got their own infrastructure. This is what I always say when they speak about competition, right? When you can't compete with me in my own infrastructure, Mekji. You can't come into my house and say you're going to compete with me in my house. If you want to compete with Eskom, at least my understanding of competition is that the end user must have a choice to purchase from this guy or from this
100%.
Guy. Now, if you want to put your power into the grid and then you are using a unitized power, how is that competition? Because you'll still be purchasing at a one price. Now, I always say that if these renewables and these private sector guys are serious about bringing competition, let them build the 38,000 kilometers of transmission network that is across the country and connect people. And then they put their power there and see if they will be able to compete with Eskom. And I can trust you, they won't.
Because their
electricity is too expensive. They will not be able. Hence, they want to sell to Eskom. They don't even want to sell to end users. They want, because they know the guys in Soweto will not buy, will not pay for power. So they want Eskom to be the one that is running after the guys in Soweto. But now they've got their money.
Got you.
So that's what they want. So you can't call that competition with me. With MTN, they've got their own
infrastructure.
To compete in that sense. So so you must hold the government accountable, Mekji. That's your job as citizens. When they say we're having this problem, what's the plan in resolving it? Let's see a workable plan. That's number one. Number two, I would agree with Mtunes. And in fact, my view has always been, you see that Department of Public Enterprise, dismantle it.
Yeah.
Put away, it's useless. It's useless.
Yeah.
Move your SAA, Transnet, Prasa to transport. You move Eskom to energy. You move Denel to defense. You move Nexa to mineral resources and energy. You have solved that. And then from there...
And those are the biggest pillars of any country.
Yes. That's what you do. You don't need that department there. It's very redundant. It's redundant.
And it's causing unnecessary confusion.
You must get rid of it. And then from there, transport, you don't put comrade bugs. You can you get a civil engineer specializing in transport engineering. You place him there.
He was fine there by sports. He was fine.
I think that's the thing. You must hold the government accountable. You must have a workable plan to say that this is the a solution that we are bringing. They must present it to the country to say that we are presenting this is the solution to this low problem. You asked a question why Ramaphosa says that it's not his duty to provide electricity. Well, according to the constitution, because probably that's what he was referencing, it can say, it will say that it's the role of the municipality.
Yeah.
But I would argue and say that the municipality accounts to the premier. The premier accounts to you. So it becomes the same thing. So what do you mean when you say it's not your responsibility? So you must be able to hold these guys accountable. They must give us a workable plan. And trust me, Mekji, you see, you don't even need to look outside. I can assure you that the people to solve Eskom 100%. Are within Eskom. Eskom has got the largest boilers in the whole African continent. So you cannot expect someone who's running 60 megawatts Molanyana boilers at Sasol to come and fix an 800 megawatt unit.
The Eskom expertise has got the largest, is in the country.
They are within there.
Fantastic. Guys, one more time, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. Podcast and chill, we out here. Boom.
Welcome to Black Excellence. Do not fear, for if you do, just sip on some grandeur. And if you still do, ask ourselves, what would Mapapunzi do? Pagama chila, itlesha lefiki. Ungo yigi, even when they ask you, how sabi in? Do not fear, for if you do, just say, Anistivi. This is the medicine of censorship. This is The Pill. Which one is that one? Podcast and Chill.